Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hello, Smart Money Tree Podcast listeners. Welcome to this week's show. My name is Kirk Chisholm. I will actually not be your host today. Today, we're going to have myself and Douglas Hegren talking about this new paradigm shift that is coming up that some people are talking about, but very few people are taking it seriously. I wanted to put this episode, this is a special breakout episode. It's not our typical format. Douglas is going to be interviewing myself. I'm going to talk a lot about this paradigm. We're going to dig into a lot of different areas, and I think you'll all enjoy it. I really wanted to get this out there because it's really hard to do in our traditional format that we have. And I will be talking a lot more about this in future episodes, but I really wanted to get this in front of you so that you're prepared. I think a lot of you are probably aware that something's going on. You feel a little bit uneasy. You can't really put your finger on it. We're going to put your finger on it with this episode. So please bring your questions to the show, email us, and we will have some of these breakout interviews as well, just talking about how you can prepare for this new paradigm shift.
All right. Good morning. This is Douglas Hegren with Mergent Group. And today we have Kirk Chisholm on with Innovative Advisor Group. Kirk is going to give some insight on what he's seeing with the markets and the economy. I know that a lot of people have questions right now. They're seeing their portfolios dip. They're hearing things about inflation. They're hearing things about what's going on with Russia and Europe. And so I thought the timing would be great to bring Kirk on here to talk a little bit about what he sees in the world of what is shifting in our economy. So welcome, Kirk.
Thanks for having me on, Doug.
You're welcome. So obviously, what I'm saying is what you're hearing and seeing too. How are you feeling about what's going on right now? What kind of thoughts do you have today?
Well, I've got a lot of thoughts, Doug. Let's just start out with some of these may be kind of a downer. It may be Debbie Downer today, but you know, in times like this, it's better to be prepared. Mm-hmm. You know, I think about COVID and that freaked out a lot of people because they weren't prepared for it. Nobody was. Nobody knew it was going to happen. But preparation is really important when we get into times like this, whether it comes to something like 2008, the early 2000s and the tech bubble, when the housing bubble burst, 2020, all these periods in time, you know, the markets are kind of indicative of what's going on in the economy. But I think a lot of people freak out because they just think that, oh, well, the late 90s, people thought that would go on forever. And anybody who knew anything about investing knew it wasn't going to go on forever, but they played along because, you know, how could you turn down 50 or 100% returns? Why would you be that stupid? But yet, the markets sold off in an enormous way and people lost a lot of money. I think what's really important is to understand what's going on. This is why we're here today, to understand what's going on and how to be more financially resilient. Financial resilience is a big topic that Doug and I talk about a lot. And it's really important because if you don't understand what's going on, then you're probably going to end up getting yourself into trouble. And that's whether you're an investor, whether you're a business owner, all aspects of your life are going to be tied to this, is this understanding of this new paradigm.
What would you describe this new paradigm? And what would you say to the people? I mean, the last time we had a really some serious impactful concerns of the market was 2007, 2008, starting with real estate. I mean, if you put that into perspective, that's, you know, 16 years since we've really seen anything that has bubbled up at the level that we may be seeing right now. And for many people, that's an entire working career that they have not really had to deal with these fundamental challenges. So what would you say to that?
Yeah, if you think about most of the people who were investing, that was what, 14 years ago now, that the real estate market sold off. And many people have only been investing for the last 14 years. They've never seen a bear market. They've never seen a recession or a depression. I mean, I would say almost nobody's seen a depression because we haven't had one in many, many decades. But
of course, you know, with that, before COVID, we hadn't really seen a pandemic since grandparents or great grandparents. So it's proof that these things happen. We just don't know when, right?
Yeah. I mean, so think of everything in terms of cycles. Right? There's really nothing new under the sun. There's only something new to us. So a pandemic, we hadn't seen one before because almost nobody was alive in the last time it happened. So nobody knew really how to react. The same thing with 2008. You know, we had a housing bubble and most people hadn't seen that before. You know, the tech bubble, all of these bubbles that happen, you look back at like the Great Depression back in the 20s and 30s. You know, you had this big run up in the 20s and everyone thought, oh, it's easy money. You know, this old adage of the shoeshine boys are giving stock advice. you know, it's when it's easy, when that's happening, it's usually a warning sign. And mm-hmm. people understand it's a warning sign, but they don't want to hear it. You just want to make easy money. There's nothing wrong with that. I think the challenge is to understand where both sides are. Is understand, it's like going to the casino, right? You keep winning, you keep winning, you keep betting. But at some point that turns around, you realize like, all right, I'm pushing away, I'm done. You know, like I had a good run, the run's over, I lost, like now it's time to just take my chips and walk away. It's hard for people to do that because that's not human nature. So you're probably all thinking, there's something going on, but I can't quite put my finger on it. You know, you have this feeling of unease. And I got a lot of calls from clients in the last like 4 years of they just didn't feel comfortable with what's going on. They didn't know why. They couldn't understand it, but they did feel uneasy. And we're going to talk about that today, about why that's happening, why you're feeling uneasy, and what to do about it.
Great. Yeah. And I've got a lot of those calls too. It's like, they didn't want to miss out. They knew the market's going up. They really didn't know what to do. And it just didn't feel right. Right. But yet it just kept rolling. So tell me about this paradigm shift that you're imagining. What is this?
The paradigm shift is this. So we've had, let's just take this in segments, right? So for the last 20 years, we've had the stock market more or less go up, right? You have this low inflation environment where the Fed has had interest rates at close to zero for close to 20 years, right? Mm-hmm. And that produces leverage in the system. Right. So you think back in like the 70s, most people didn't have mortgages, right? They just bought a house and houses were cheaper. But then all of a sudden mortgages became a thing, right? So now you can put down 20% and own a house. Well, now you can afford a lot more, right? You don't need to come up with $40,000. Now you can come up with, you want a $200,000 house. Things have changed dramatically in the system, and that's provided a lot of leverage or inflation. So in the last 20 years, we've had low interest rates, which have allowed people to borrow at really low rates. I think one of my credit cards is like 4% interest. I mean, it's ridiculous, right?
That's incredible. Yeah.
Right. And mortgage, 30-year mortgages, like 6 months ago, were 2%. 2% for a 30-year mortgage? Are you kidding me? And you wonder why real estate prices have gone through the roof. Now, as of today, the mortgage rates are about 5.25%.
Quick jump.
Yeah, if mortgage rates go to 7.5%, your monthly payments will have doubled. Can you afford the same house? No.
Yeah, I think I've heard that right now, over a year ago, 55% more expensive to get a mortgage for the same amount than last year. That's a huge impact on cash flow and household.
Right. And especially as most people are living off of cash flow, they're not living off of savings. So you don't save up $1 million to buy a house. You save up $200,000 to buy $1 million house. And then hopefully you can have the interest payments equal what you can spend every single month. That's how people afford the house. But now that interest payments have doubled, now you can afford half the house. That's not good, right? If you think about the economy.
And the banks lend to that too. So it's not only an affordability factor, but now the banks aren't even going to give you near as much as they gave you before. So maybe you would have gotten $600,000 for a certain monthly mortgage payment. Now they may only give you $450,000 for that or $400,000 for that. So now you don't even have the money to necessarily go out and get the home you're looking for at the prices that it's been.
Right. I mean, I talked to a contractor the other day and he was building a house and he had a buyer all lined up and the buyer backed out. He said, I can't qualify for a mortgage anymore. He's like, I want it, but I can't qualify. So the guy's like, all right, we'll have to find somebody else. So we had this period in time, really the last 40 years, especially the last 20, where inflation has caused prices to go through the roof in all aspects of society. We just talked about real estate, but it impacts everything, right? So all of this cheap and easy money has allowed prices to go up everywhere. So this is what we call inflation, or price inflation more accurately.
Well, answer this for me, because I only heard recently, or this is something I hear from clients, inflation just went up, right? That, you know, we were in low inflation environments for the last 20 years. But a lot of clients feel like things have gotten expensive. So how were we in low inflation environments when things, you know, like real estate and other areas were obviously going up at pretty, you know, extravagant rates?
So inflation's a tough topic because you typically have people on both sides of it. One side thinks we're going to have hyperinflation and the dollar's going to go to zero and they usually end up being gold bucks. Nothing wrong with that, but I think that's an extreme opinion. On the other side, people think, oh, there's going to be deflation and everything's going to go to zero. And that's also probably an extreme opinion.
Okay.
The problem is inflation is a complicated topic. And let me explain it a little bit so that people really understand it.
I think that'll be helpful.
Yeah. Inflation itself is an adjective, but people treat it as a noun. Inflation is really nothing. Inflation is a descriptor. It describes something. So is it price inflation? Is it asset inflation? Is it real estate inflation? Is it wage inflation? All of these things have to be attached to something. People just call it inflation. They just say, oh, it's printing of money. It's not that simple. That is an aspect of it. You could say, yes, there's, you know, the amount of money being printed is inflationary, but we haven't seen that. So up until the last 20 years, we've had low inflation, low interest rate. We'll call it low interest rates or the CPI. Most people tie inflation to the CPI. So when I say inflation, what I'm really talking about is the CPI or consumer price index. That's how the government measures inflation. People argue whether it's right or wrong. I'm not going to do that here because it's irrelevant. So let's just assume it's correct. The CPI has been low for a long period of time. And our interest rates have been really low to boot. Now, that has caused asset prices to skyrocket. Your stock portfolios, your real estate prices, they've skyrocketed because of low interest rates. And what that means is low interest rates allow you to afford more.
Okay.
So it gives you more money, right? I call it leverage, but it's basically you have more money okay. in order to do things with. But that is not true everywhere. So low inflation, we'll call it 2-3% in the last 20 years. College prices have gone up 7.5% a year. That's high inflation. Medical costs have gone up through the roof. Yet commodity prices have been deflationary. Commodity prices have been going down for the last 20 years. And I'm not including the last year because things have changed since COVID. But prior to COVID, commodity prices were going down so much so that the people stopped producing because they just couldn't make any money. Farmers were having a tough time. Oil producers stopped. So inflation is not necessarily all-encompassing. Not everything is going up. So okay. commodity prices have gone down. Wages have stagnated for the last 20 years, right? So even though we have this environment where asset prices are going up, wages are not. They're stagnant. I mean, they go up and down, but over the last 20 years, they've basically been neutral. Okay. So there are aspects like that happen in society, and people look at it and say, oh, there's inflation. Well, not necessarily. It just depends on what you're talking about. I'll give you another example. Take COVID. COVID mm-hmm. is a perfect example. People say, oh, well, the Fed printed a lot of money, which caused huge inflation.
We hear that all the time. Yeah, everybody's saying that. It's all over the news and blogs.
Right, but it's not true. So the last 20 years, the Fed has doubled the money supply every presidential term, basically every 8 years, they've doubled the money supply. It's been concentrated, right? During COVID, they concentrated it. But what ends up happening is, so think of, let me talk about two different pieces. How is money created? Money is created in one of two ways. It's either printed by the government or it's created by banks. Banks are historically the way that money is printed in our society. And it's basically done by an expanding economy, allows banks to lend more and it creates more money. I don't want to get too much into the weeds of how that's done, but basically assume that banks are creating money by their lending. Okay. The Fed can also print money as they've done during COVID, and they can give it out as in, you know, PPP loans and EIDL loans. All of that is a form of them printing money. So they printed a lot of money, but it's no different than any other time. People assume that money printing causes inflation. It didn't cause inflation in 2008. It didn't cause inflation from 2008 up until the COVID crisis. People assume that the money printing in COVID was the inflation was caused by the money printing. Actually, it wasn't, which I'll get into in a minute.
Okay.
But let's look at the COVID period, 2020, 2022. You had inflation for things like bicycles, medical care, newspapers, cable TV, cleaning products, food at home.
Toilet paper,
yeah. But we had deflation for things like food at work or school, shoes, city transportation, hotels, travel, dresses, suits, airfare. All of that was deflationary. I mean, airfare was down like 23%. So
hey, talking about the toilet paper, you know, again, you know, people are like, wait a second, what is there the supply? Why are these toilet paper companies struggling even though the prices are up? Well, it's because most of the paper that's produced out there was commercial paper and offices were closed. So it was actually, even though we as consumers saw a shortage of consumer paper, toilet paper, and we saw the prices go up there, overall, these businesses were actually struggling because they lost a tremendous client base that they would normally have in a healthy economy.
Yeah. And we'll get to the how do you protect yourself in a little bit. But so I call this whole concept inflation, because there's actually a bunch of dynamics going on. There's inflation, which we're seeing right now in the CPI, and we're seeing it in commodity prices, and you're seeing it in food costs, you're seeing it in energy costs. That's inflationary. But you're seeing deflation in asset prices. And you're starting to see it in real estate, you're seeing it in stocks, you're seeing it a lot of in bonds. There's a lot of areas where we're seeing deflationary pressures. So just understand that this is a very dynamic thing, and it's going to confuse the heck out of you. So I'm trying to simplify this. It confuses the experts. So yeah,
indeed.
Yeah, I call it inflation because basically when you have this kind of environment, it causes mass confusion. If you think something's logical, it's probably not going to happen. We've had some of the top hedge fund managers retire in the last 20 years because they just say, I can't understand this environment anymore, because it's got increasingly confusing. It's more confusing because you'd think, well, money printing equals inflation, but that doesn't happen. Or you think, oh, low commodity prices, that's going to lead to more profits. Well, not necessarily. It just depends on the situation. So what I'm getting to is right now, and part of the reason we're having this, Doug and I are having this talk and we're sharing this with you, is because we're concerned about this paradigm shift. And we're trying to educate people on how to prepare for this. Big part of that preparation comes from understanding what's going on and spending the time to think about how to prepare. Mm-hmm. Now, understanding the inflation, understand that it's confusing. There are things that are going to happen. You're going to say, whoa, I might be wrong. Well, there are certain things that I'm going to tell you about how to know when you're wrong, right?
Hey, Kurt, can I back up for 1 second? With all of that confusion and what you just said about the hedge funds, would you agree that based on that and being as difficult it is to button it up into a simple answer one way or the other, that a lot of the stuff that people are hearing out there from individuals who are talking on the news and through the media and blogs are simplifying things or potentially not necessarily giving all of the information about what's going on, that it's more confusing and what you may be hearing may be either overly simplified or just in fact wrong?
Yeah, I don't want to call it fake news, but you know, if you think about the old Far Side cartoon and there's like four people touching an elephant and they're like, oh, this is a wall or you know, this is paper or this is, you know, a spear. They're all looking at the elephant and they're seeing certain parts of it. This is what you get in a large part from the media. People want headlines and they're willing to say anything they can to get them. That is the media nowadays, whether it's financial media or news or politics, it's all the same. And if you don't know that's true, I would take a closer look, because that's basically how people get attention now, is by creating narratives. Now, I'm not going to say that I have all the answers, but I know how to prepare for this. I've been through this multiple times. I've been doing this for the last 24 years. I can tell you that there are times where I know that things are squirrely, and this is one of those times. We're very good at risk management. That is what we excel at, is risk management. So times like this is when we excel. So what I'm going to talk about here is mm-hmm. how to protect yourself, okay. how to know when you're wrong, and how to make changes. Now, obviously, we do a lot of this actively for our clients, but you know, some of you may want to do this yourself, and it's really important to understand these dynamics. So
I think this will be really valuable for what the questions that people have right now. So thank you. Continue.
So let's talk about what's going on in simplistic terms. So right now, since really 2008, maybe prior to that, maybe the early 2000s, the Federal Reserve has dictated where asset prices are going. Okay. You know, they have certain mandates, and you could argue whether they follow them or whether they should follow them. The reality is the Fed is controlling the markets. They're the one single lever that you can look at and know what the direction is. So right now, the Federal Reserve has basically said, we're going to fight inflation, which means they're going to raise interest rates. And they've been doing it sharply. And they probably need to do it more. But when you have inflation in 8-9% annualized, that's a lot. right? Especially since we've had 2% or less in the last like 20 years, right?
Just like mortgage rates, big jump, bam. And there's going to be impact from that.
And people are caught off guard. They weren't aware that this was going to happen or happen quickly, but it has. And so the Fed has deemed that they're going to fight inflation by raising rates. They're talking about, let's say, 2.25, 2.5 this year. They're going to argue that for the next, you know, 9 months. So I'm not going to make that argument. But they are talking a tough game. Now, you have one side of it, which is they're trying to fight inflation. The other side of it is they're trying to protect the economy because they don't want a stock market crash. They don't want another great recession or great depression like we had where the stock market goes down 90%. They don't want that. So they're trying to balance the two. And they're always trying to balance the two. So what they say and what they do could be very different.
So what you would say is they're in a very tough spot right now between the balance of overcorrecting and creating a catastrophic economic crash versus undercorrecting and creating hyperinflation.
Correct. So what the Fed fears most is deflation, which it shouldn't
what
be.
What is that?
We'll get into that. So let's talk about Japan.
All right.
Japan in 1980, they had a stock market boom. The stock market went to probably the highest it's ever gone when it comes to their markets. It has subsequently gone down for 20 years, 22 years.
Wow.
And they've hit deflation. Everyone's worried about it because if you saw what happened to Japan, you'd see that there was a dramatic deflationary effect that they couldn't get out of. They were trying to get out of and they couldn't. Now, there's a lot that goes into it. They have demographics, like people are getting older and all those sort of things. And that's a bit of a problem for them. But basically, Japan is their worst fear because they don't have tools to fight deflation. They only have tools to fight inflation. So they're very worried about that. So what the Fed has been doing in 2000, early 2000s, what happened was the stock market crashed from tech stocks. And effectively, since then, they've been trying to create inflation. So there's a dramatic amount of deflation in the system. And it happened then. So what they did in the early 2000s is they decided to cause inflation by boosting the housing market. So they lowered interest rates. Everyone put their money into housing and they said, hey, great, let's just make as much money as we can, leverage it up, you know, ninja loans, all that crazy stuff that happened. That was their way of getting away from deflation. Now, what they did was they caused a lot of leverage in the system and they basically... What they do is they pull forward future earning or wages. So if you think about it this way, what they're doing with their policy is they're saying, hey, you should borrow money today that you need some future date because it's better off using it today. So what happens is you still have to pay that money back.
There's a day it comes due for sure.
Right. So let's take a simple example. You make $50,000 a year. And let's say your expenses are whatever, $30,000. So you got $20,000 a year to spend. Now, let's say you decide, well, I really want that house worth $100,000. Well, now your interest payments, you know, let's say your interest payments are $5,000 a month. Well, now you got $5,000 less a month to spend on other things because you wanted that house. You didn't wait to save up enough money for the house. You bought it today, but you're still going to have to pay it back over the next 30 years. So effectively, you've got these interest payments for 30 years you have to pay back, which means you can't use that money for other things. That's effectively what pulling forward future earnings is. You know, it's the old Popeye cartoon where Wimpy said, I'll pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today, right?
That's right.
That's effectively what it is, right? Although, you know, he didn't pay it back, but that's kind of how it works. What it does is it actually slows down the economy. Because you're pulling forward that growth. So what they did is they pulled forward future growth into today and they caused that housing boom. But then that crashed.
Vicious cycle.
Yeah. Yep. But then that crashed. So they had to do it again. So they kept interest rates really low and they boosted the stock market from 2009 up until recently. And it peaked out and it just kept going because the Fed just said, hey, we're just going to keep this party going. And they tried not to make it go too fast. But, you know, at some point, there's a top. At some point, things are too expensive. So let's take an example. Warren Buffett uses this indicator for himself, which is the total stock market value compared to GDP.
Mm-hmm.
As of right now, it is more expensive than it's ever been.
All time, ever.
Of all time, yes.
Wow.
And to boot, it is twice what it is normally. So a normal range would be basically half of what it is now. And that's not even a discount. That's just a normal range historically. So it's usually about like 80. The marker is basically between 80 and 120. Right now we're about 220. So basically, if the GDP rises quite a bit, that's one way you could get it back to normal, or the stock market could crash. And I'm not suggesting it will, but that's basically how it normalizes.
So bring the prices back down or start figuring out how to produce stuff.
Right, which I would say the GDP is going to be hard since it was negative recently. So that puts things into context, right? And this isn't to say we're going to get a crash tomorrow. I'm not one of those doomsdayers who's going to say, oh, you got to jump out your first floor window because you're too scared. No, you shouldn't be scared.
Check your email for that blog. You've probably got plenty of people sending that stuff to you.
Yeah, that's everywhere. Everyone's right. Trying to promote fear. I don't promote fear. I promote knowledge. And with that knowledge, it will allow you to not be afraid when these things happen. That's really what's important.
Knowledge is power.
Yep. So understanding this dynamic of Japan, right, and not becoming Japan is really important. But the Fed has put themselves into this corner. So they've inflated for the last 20 years, basically, and now they're cornered themselves. What has happened with COVID is this inflation we're seeing is not due to the Federal Reserve. This is where a lot of people get it wrong. They say, oh, they printed a lot of money. That's why we have inflation. No, that is not why we have inflation. It is incorrect. The reason we have inflation is because of the supply chain. The supply chain is broken. So if you look back in the 70s, and any of you who like history, I would highly recommend you go back and read the 70s because that is going to give you a good indication of what we might experience. Okay. So what happened in the 70s is we had that oil shock. And there were lines for miles long to get standing in line for gas. That was because we didn't have the supply. So prices went through the roof. We have the same problem now. I talk to a lot of different clients in every industry that you can imagine that are involved in the supply chain, and they all have a uniform response. This is a supply chain problem, and it's not going away. They cannot see the end of this. At some point, I imagine it will. They said, you know, if God came down and said he'd fix it, it would still take 18 months, right? That's the closest. And we're probably looking 3 to 5 years. And depending on what happens with the economy, that will dictate. But you should plan on 3 to 5 years. So this inflation is not going away because it has nothing to do with monetary policy.
I just spoke to someone over the weekend that was looking to do an add-on build for a nice house of theirs, about $500,000. And for some reason, it didn't go through a year ago. So they just got the new quotes on what it would cost. It's now up to 1.3 for the same project.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, my father-in-law did a renovation on his house. And the first quote he got, he was working with a contractor. Contractor ended up dying. Like, it was a sad thing. Oh, but man. He had to go find a new contractor. And the guy like added, I think it was like 45% onto the price. He's just like, sorry, the price have gone up so much. I can't even do it for that. So, you know, and the problem is in part because all these businesses are adding on margin. So that's a big part of this is they're taking more profits than they should because they can, but also because their prices are going up. I mean, if you want semiconductors, you can't get them. I will say that I heard in the military, there are certain parts of the military that are cannibalizing some equipment for other equipment because they don't have extra resources. Like no one does. You know, you see these stories in the news, they're trying to make more javelins for the war. And they're like, yeah, it's going to take us a year to ramp up production just to double our capacity. And that's the military. You'd think the military's got first priority and they can't get them. So it's a rare problem that happens. It's happening now. There aren't people out there with solutions because it's not a singular problem. The problem is we had this on-demand supply chain that was just-in-time supply chain that people are realizing was really stupid because it was fragile. Right, you and I talk about this a lot, Doug, about, you know, like fragility and resilience. This is a fragile system that all it took was one speed bump and it broke. And now they have to create resilience around it, but that's going to take years. If you have, let's just say, problems in China, well, now you got to build that capacity in the US. It's going to cost more. You have to build the plant. You know, these semiconductor plants take years to build.
And I'm hearing that companies are starting to consider bringing some of that manufacturing back because they've seen what can happen if all of a sudden they're kind of held hostage to this supply chain issue.
It's a huge trend, And this is where the onshoring comes into play. We'll talk a little bit about that. Mm-hmm. But understanding this is really important because you're going to hear a lot of garbage out there. People are going to be throwing stuff against the wall. Oh, it's because the Fed printed money and this and that. No, if you think that, you're not going to understand the problem. So you should be prepared for the next 3 to 5 years there to be high inflation or high-ish inflation. I don't know if it's going to keep going up or it's going to stay the same. I don't know the future, and I'm not going to pretend to. But I do know that we're going to have high inflation for the next 3 to 5 years, at least until this is fixed. Okay. So understanding that, the Fed has a decision to make. What do? Do they protect the economy by keeping interest rates low? Or do they raise interest rates to try to slow the economy to help that supply chain problem, meaning reduce the demand, which is another way to fix it, is to reduce demand. Now, that may not stay there forever, but it's one solution. And that's, I think, what they're trying to do. So right now, the Federal Reserve has basically chosen to fight inflation versus protect the economy. Knowing that, that means the economy is going to take a hit. That means the stock market is going to take a hit. If you've had your money in the market up till now, you know this, because the market is down across the board in most industries. You have bonds are down. I mean, 30-year treasuries at the end of the quarter, I think we're down 20%. 20% for safe
bonds. For the safe bonds, absolutely.
If you can't see the video, I'm air quoting safe bonds. So this is what I talk about, a paradigm shift. You have to look at all the assumptions you're making about your life when it comes to finances. Everything you assumed might change. Up and from pretty much the 80s up until today, bonds were in a 40-year bull market, the longest bull market in bonds that have happened in a long time. So that bond bull market means basically, yes, they were safe because interest rates kept declining, which means that you kept making money on top of the interest payments. Of course they were safe. But once the bull market is over and it's a bear market, they're no longer safe. And everyone who says bonds are safe is going to get you into trouble. Now, this is not to say that they're going to go up or down, but I have not had my money in bonds for the last 5 years because I knew we were close to the end. When you hit zero, what are you gaining from bonds? You know, I'm not making any recommendations here, but I will tell you that bonds are not safe. And if you have a lot of money in bonds, you need to find a safe solution to that. And there are some, not many, but there are some. So bonds are not safe. Stocks are certainly not safe. Commodity prices have gone up a lot. There are certain assets that should do reasonably well during this time, and we'll talk about some of those. But what I really want to convey first is how to understand this paradigm shift. So all of these assumptions, here's another assumption. It's what I call a half truth. Buy and hold is the best way to invest. And most people think buy and hold is a great strategy.
Or buy the dip. I've heard this one too.
Buy the dip's another one. Yes, buy the dip. Let's start with buy and hold, then we'll hit buy the dip because they're both important. So buy and hold worked really well in the 80s and 90s because the market just kept going up. It also worked really well from 2009 till today. You just buy and hold because eventually it'll come back. That only works during bull markets. It doesn't work during bear markets. I'll give you an example. 2000 to 2013, you made no money for 13 years. Now you say, well, yeah, it eventually came back. Yeah, but you lost 13 years of compounding. You might as well just stuck your money under a mattress, right?
That's a long time. That's half of some people's working years.
So that is a half truth. Yes, it works when we're in a bull market. I would argue we're not in a bull market anymore. Right now, I'd argue we're in a bear market, and most people don't realize it. So this brings in buy the dip. Buy the dip works when you're buying and holding in a bull market. When you're in a bear market, buy the dip ends up costing you a lot of money. Now look at the NASDAQ. There were 50% of the NASDAQ stocks are down 50% or more. 20% of NASDAQ stocks are down like 75% or more. Now, there are a lot of people who are still buying those dips all the way down.
I see it all the time. I see it on Twitter and all of these places, buy the dip. You know, I'm putting more money in right now because I'm getting it cheap right now.
Yeah, and it'll get cheap and it'll keep getting cheaper because even though it's down 70%, let's say, let's assume that earnings are staying the same. Earnings are not going to stay the same. If we go into a recession, earnings are going to dip, which means it goes down even more. So the hard part about bear markets is they reverse all of the assumptions that you've made. Buy the dip, buy and hold, bonds are safe, stocks are, you know, all this stuff that you understand to be true is only half true. It's true sometimes, but it's not true all the times. And what you need to understand is when it's not true. And right now is one of those times where it's not necessarily true. And there will be times where that actually comes back and things will go back to a normal-ish kind of paradigm, but we're in a different paradigm. Now, one of the other challenges that you're going to see is during 2022, or let's say today, COVID basically accelerated a lot of the trends of work from home, of, you know, virtual meetings, all of these trends that happened during COVID. Those trends already existed. They just COVID accelerated them, right? Mm-hmm. And COVID caused a lot of changes. Now, it took about a year, year and a half before people realized that, hey, I like this new paradigm and I don't want it to change. I don't want to go to the office when I can work from home. I can go move from San Francisco to Lake Tahoe and have a beautiful surroundings. I'm not going back to work. I'm going to live out here in Lake Tahoe. So you have these fights, even from tech companies. All these companies are fighting to get their employees back. And the employee's like, no, I have a better quality of life. Why do I want to go back? So it didn't take long before people's habits changed. They realized, like, I like this. I built an office. It's great.
That's a paradigm shift right there. I mean, good luck changing that mentality for a next generation when they've become accustomed to being able to do this. I know companies like JP Morgan Chase are fighting hard against that, but time will tell who's going to win on this battle. And I think the paradigm will probably win and the companies are going to have to adapt.
Yes, that's exactly it. The employees make the rules, right? And that's unions are a good indication of that. You know, unions, they unionize and they dictate rules for the company. It's the same thing. So if people are used to this new paradigm, they don't want to go back. So this is an example. Right now, we're experiencing the start of a paradigm shift. It's going to take a while for people to A, realize what's going on, but also to change their habits. So high inflation causes a lot of problems. And people are probably starting to realize this. Good example, gas prices. In the last 9 months, my gas prices for fill my car have gone up 70%. My food prices have doubled in the last 6 months.
My utility bill, I've looked at it recently. I think we're averaging about $250 for all of our utilities last year. It's $450 now. It's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, that's going to start to happen. Let's take an example of how all this impacts you. Everyone needs food. And everyone needs energy, whether it's gas to drive your car, energy to heat your house, whatever it is. But that's all gone up in price. So let's assume everything has doubled. Normally, it might cost $500 a month to feed a family of four with food. Let's say it's $500. My food price have doubled. Now it's $1,000 a month to feed that same family. Well, I didn't make an extra $500 in my job, right? My job is salaried. I made the same amount. So I basically just lost $500 a month. If that money's going somewhere, now I have to take that extra $500 from somewhere. So instead of buying, let's just assume you're not saving any because that complicates it. If you're saving, you could take it from savings. But generally, if let's just say for most Americans who are not saving because they can't make ends meet, so they're not saving anything, that $500 has to come from somewhere. Well, maybe you buy fewer clothes. Maybe the clothes you buy are cheaper. Maybe you're buying fewer iPhones or tablets or computers or TVs, all of these discretionary items that you use for luxuries that we've gotten away with for 20 years because everyone's got plenty of money. Now that money is going to have to come from somewhere. So people are going to buy less stuff, discretionary items, especially. You're going to travel less. You're going to stay at fewer hotels. Now those industries they're not going to do as well because there's fewer dollars going there. And then that's going to ripple through the economy because those industries employ people. Those employees are going to have less money. They're going to have less money to spend. So it's going to be a cycle. And this is why it takes a while. It doesn't happen right away. It might take a year or two, but in a year or two, people's habits are going to change. They're going to be spending less. They're going to start reducing their expenses, paying down debt, all of the things that are deflationary to this economy. And they're going to cause a lot of problems. Not problems in general. For individuals, it's going to be better. But for the economy, it's going to cause problems. So this is where the Fed gets into this tug of war of inflation or deflation, is they're trying to balance this. The problem is one of these is going to win out, and it's neither solution is going to be good, but one solution might be better than the other. But either way, you have to prepare for both.
Is it an either or could you have both at the same time? I mean, could elaborate on that a little bit.
This is why I laugh every time I hear people talking about inflation, because people talk about inflation like, oh, like we're going to have inflation. We have deflation. It's always this battle of who's going to win. The funny thing is you can have both at the same time. This is what I think a lot of people struggle with, is you can have inflation and deflation at the same time. Good example. right now we have asset price deflation, but yet we have commodity price inflation. Or in COVID, we talked about some of the items that were inflationary and deflationary. There's a great quote by F. Scott Fitzgerald, which I love, which is, "The test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposing ideas in the mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function." It's amazing how hard this is, but people can't fathom, wait, how do you have both? Because they think of inflation in very specific binary terms, and it's not binary. It is a complex thing, what's going on. I mean, the CPI went up a lot in large part because of used car prices. Well, what about the rest of the items? Well, the rest of the items didn't go up as much, but now used car prices are going down, yet everything else is going up. So it's a complex equation, which is why the government puts out the CPI. And like I said, a lot of people argue whether it's accurate or not. I think the inflation is a lot higher than they dictate, but that doesn't really matter.
Feels like it.
Yeah. Part of the reason is because they don't include food and energy because it's too volatile.
That's what I'm paying the most for.
Right. And that affects everybody. So everybody, not everybody's putting their kids through college, but everyone's got to feed their family and has to put gas in the car. So if you look at things like that, they're highly inflationary. And those are kind of things that you should be watching for. Now, the reason that we're talking about this is because once you understand all these dynamics, your habits are going to change. And one of the biggest things with inflation or this type of, I'll call it this type of environment because it's not just inflation. The thing with this type of environment that you have to be careful for is this causes mass confusion. Most people don't realize that this is happening. They try to make sense of it. We talked about it earlier, like you kind of have a finger on the pulse. You don't know what's going on, but you feel something's wrong. This is the reason, because it confuses people.
That intuition, that nervous tension there, like something strange going on. It's a survival mechanism.
It is. And it's like that sixth sense, right? You kind of know something's going on, but you don't know what it is. So you're kind of alert. We're going to talk about how to protect yourself. Now, I want to talk about a few paradigms that are going on, both positive and negative. Okay. So here are some things that are happening. Globalization. Globalization for the last 20 years has had a huge impact on the U.S. economy. Now, what it has done is allowed us to export our inflation to Asian countries where we've outsourced our work to, right? They're doing low-cost labor stuff. You can get your iPhone cheaper because they're making it in China. So we're outsourcing that inflation to places like China, Vietnam. So globalization has been a big reason why we've had deflationary forces for the last 20 years. And people are like, oh, we have inflation. No, we don't. Because there are trends that are impacting inflation. You can print a lot of money, but if you're outsourcing the inflationary effect to China, you're not going to see it. Okay. That effect has happened. That has changed. We've gone from globalization to decoupling or deglobalization. Trump started it by kicking the sand in the face of other countries because he said, hey, why are you taking advantage of us? And that trend has continued.
Like the tariffs that they announced a couple of years ago, things like that.
Yeah. The tariffs, but look at it now. I mean, we're continuing that trend because we realize that China is a big weak point for us. You know, look at the supply chain, huge problem. It's broken because we had this supply chain based on other countries when other countries could easily make a quick change. I mean, look at the Ukraine war has caused a big problem and amongst other countries.
That'll be an issue for wheat.
Yeah.
Which again, we kind of need.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people need wheat. You know? I don't know if you need it, but a lot of people need it.
A lot of people, it's a lot of things.
So that's a huge trend, is the globalization change. We also have demographics, which is a slow change, but part of the reason Japan is in deflation is because demographics are not in their favor. People are getting older. They're not having as many kids. The U.S. has the same problem. There's just people are getting older. You know, they're not having as many kids. That's not a big shift, but it's a small shift. China is having this problem. So there's a huge deflationary effect there. Another one is real estate. So right now, real estate has been skyrocketing because of low interest rates. Now interest rates are going up. Real estate has started to change in price. It's starting to decline. Now, this is going to take a while, so I'm not going to call the top. But you know, if I had to say, it was probably when interest rates were 2%. That's probably the top. Although it's going to be slow to change, it is going to happen. Well,
mortgage brokers and real estate agents tell me that real estate always goes up.
Well, look at 2008. You know when it peaked? Real estate peaked 2005. It took until 2008 to actually affect the markets. That's 3 years. That's a long time.
Big cycle.
People didn't know it peaked. People were still buying for 3 years because they didn't know it peaked. And some of them that did know, they said, oh, we'll buy the dip, right? The whole mentality. That worked out well for them. So the point is, you know, understanding real estate is really important. Residential is probably going to start declining because while people still need a place to live, they can't afford real estate in the same way they could before.
So it's more than just supply and demand, because you keep hearing, well, there's just so much demand for real estate, it's just going to keep going up. But the monetary issue of being able to get approval from banks has a little bit to do with that.
So that's a great point. And I've struggled with this for the last like 7 years. Is at what point does real estate top? Is it because of interest rates or is it because of supply and demand? Supply and demand is extremely strong. We don't have enough housing for the people we have. That has been a problem, and that is going to drive prices. However, people don't need to own a home. I know the mortgage and the real estate industry have convinced you all that you need to own a home because the American dream, you don't. What you need to do is have a place to live.
Place to sleep.
So yep. Around here, $1 million home, you could rent a home, that same home, for half the cost. If it costs, let's say, $10,000 a month to own that home, it would cost you $5,000 a month to rent it.
And less.
Why would you own
and
it?
And less maintenance.
You know, right. It all bakes in.
It's part of that.
Okay. Because you don't have to pay for CapEx, capital expenditures, fixing a roof. You don't have to pay for taxes, utility, you know, all this stuff you don't have to pay for, like sewage. But renting is really easy. They take care of the home for you. And, you know, you have to, you know, deal with the fact that rent might go up. But the reality is you're not tied to that. So real estate is an interesting category because it's not uniform. Residential, I think, is going to be a problem, but apartments will be fine. If you own an apartment building, you'll be fine because people need a place to live, mm-hmm. and renting will be a lot cheaper.
What about investment real estate, like owning a home and renting a single detached home? How do you feel about that? Versus like apartments, which have obviously the ability to house many people under one property.
I think investment property is going to depend on what it is. Like single family will be treated like a residential house, whether you own it or you rent it out. So I think if things go down, that will go down as well. Mm-hmm. If you're never going to sell it, then it really doesn't matter. But I think the interest payments are going to be a challenge for new people. So prices will probably most likely decline. So here's the problem. If we go into a recession, people are going to have less money overall, which means it's a deflationary force, right? As wages... We have the lowest unemployment we have ever had, according to Biden. Of course, I know he's taking credit for it, but you know, it's just the coming out of COVID. Prior to that, it was low too. It's just an economic trend that's happened is we have low unemployment. That's going to start to change at some point, because once people's habits change, companies start cutting their employees, which means there's fewer people employed. That ripples through the economy.
So they couldn't get workers, and eventually they won't need them. So it's
right.
A lot of opposing forces.
And they'll find ways to outsource that, because, you know, why would you pay an employee when you could pay a contractor, you know, for less? So a lot of those trends are going to start to happen again. So rental property, you know, I think is hard. I think if you were to put money into real estate, it would be in apartment buildings or in manufacturing, mm-hmm. industrial property that does manufacturing, because there's going to be a lot more onshoring. That's going to be a big trend, the onshoring of manufacturing. So that's where I would put it. I wouldn't really put it anywhere else, because a commercial is going to be tough. And residential, I think, is going to be tough in large part. We talked about investing, buy and hold. There's this trend of active versus passive investing. Passive investing is kind of the buy and hold. I think that's going to actually take a hit, because people are going to realize that we might hit the 70s again, which was a long period of time where the markets went up and down, but basically sideways. And it wasn't a great environment for investing. Mm-hmm. Some investing, yes, but I think in large part it was tough. So I think in general, active investing is going to be better. You want somebody who actually knows where the trends are going, who's following that. Mm-hmm. Somebody who's on top of it, somebody who's managing the risk. Mm-hmm. Like if you're fully exposed to the stock market right now, you're in trouble. And I think that's going to be a huge problem going forward, is people are going to, they're going to wait it out. And then the market, I mean, I'm not making a prediction, but the market could go down another 40 to 60% from here. And that would be normal, right? In historical context, right? I'm not saying that should happen. But if you look at historical context of what happens during these times, 40 to 60% drawdown is normal. Beyond 60, I think, is abnormal. Mm-hmm. And that's not saying a lot, right? You talked about earlier with the Buffett indicator, 50% would bring you back to historical norms. And it, you know, it might even go lower than that. Who knows? A lot of this is dependent upon the Fed, so I don't want to try to predict the future. But I do want to just tell you that you should expect this, mm-hmm. that this could happen, right? This is a scenario that could happen, okay? So active investing is really important. You want somebody who's not just buying FANG stocks and holding, because if that's what you're doing, then you're pretty much going to be in trouble. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get into the weeds too much, but there's a lot of reasons why passive investing will probably end up getting hurt more because there's a lot of the tech stocks in there.
What about an S&P 500 index fund? A lot of people just say that's the only thing you should buy. They've been saying that for years, a lot of the blogs and things like that. So how do you feel about, you know, just kind of buying the index?
Buying the index, I think historically has been a good idea. If you don't know what you're doing, indexing is not a bad idea. Mm-hmm. The problem is at the peak, five biggest stocks were, I think, somewhere between 20 or 25% of that index. So I think it was like Apple, Tesla, Microsoft, you know, Amazon, Google, like, you know, basically the FANG
stock. A lot of tech.
Yeah, that's all tech, right? Mm-hmm. And that's been doing poorly and probably will continue to do poorly. That was 20 to 25% of the index. So what about the rest of the companies that are fine? The way the index works, it works based on market. I don't want to get in the weeds, but basically mm-hmm. the largest stocks get a bigger slice of the pie in the index. And that if they equally weighted it, it actually would be a better way to do it.
So if we're concerned about tech, the S&P, an index fund may exacerbate this problem a little bit due to the concentration of what its return is based off of. Okay, that's helpful.
Yep. So basically stocks are going to have a rough time. Bonds, commodities should do well. Things like precious metals should hold up fine. Mm-hmm. I think if you look back in the 70s, historically, they did really well during that period. However, you also have to take in mind, because you're going to hear a lot of the gold bugs say, oh, gold and silver, just like the 70s. Yeah, we're not quite like the 70s. I would say 70s is the closest that we'll come to finding a comparison in recent history. Mm-hmm. But it's not the same, because also, you know, the dollar was pegged to gold, which they decoupled from gold, which caused gold to shoot through the roof. Mm-hmm. So there are reasons why gold went up beyond just being in the 70s. I think it's a good safe haven, but it's not going to be exactly the same. I think people need to understand that. Mm-hmm. We talked about real estate, buying versus renting. One fundamental rule to keep in mind is you want to maintain flexibility. You want to be as flexible as possible. That's why renting is a good idea, because it allows you to change mm-hmm. as things are needed, right? You know, if you're a business owner, you might fire employees and hire them as back as a contractor. That would be an example. Flexibility. Rule number one, especially for business owners, but this applies to individuals. You want to identify all of your vulnerabilities or risks. Job number one is to identify them all. And then from there, work towards minimizing them as much as possible. If you owe a lot of debt, pay down your debt, especially variable debt. You know, fixed debt. Okay. You know, if you have a 2% mortgage, keep it. I mean, you're not going to go wrong with 2% mortgage.
If it's collateralized, it's deductible, it's low interest, that's a different story. But variable, uncollateralized, undeductible debt, make that a priority and get rid of that as soon as possible.
Yeah. Credit cards, good example. Mm-hmm. Get rid of your credit card debt, right? Those are great examples of what you want to get rid of. So things like that are important to pay down those kind of risks. Identify where the risks are. Do you have a risk from government intervention? You know, depending on your industry, do you have a risk of unions or labor? Like I can't come up with a huge list, but you're going to know what your risks are in your life. So you need to identify those. And if you can't identify them, you know, let Doug or I know, we can walk you through that, because that's a lot of what we do in the process is risk management. Mm-hmm. So one thing you want to do is focus on resilience. We talk about this topic of financial resilience. The last 20 plus years have been focused on leverage, and inflation was all about get as much leverage as you can, because prices are going to go up and that cost of that debt is going to basically devalue itself over time. That is reversed, right? So what happened in Japan, a good example is in Japan, and this is a scary thing, and I don't want to scare people too much, and this is why renting's better. Let's say you own a piece of real estate, $100,000. You have a mortgage on it, $20,000 mortgage, so 80-20, right? Mm-hmm. If that real estate goes up, you know, 5%, now it's worth $105,000, you know, you just made $5,000, right? And, you know, you still have $80,000 in mortgage, right? Mm-hmm. So that didn't change. What if it changes? What if it goes down 5%? Well, now instead of 20,000, now you have 15,000. What about 10%? Now you have 10,000, right? So at a certain point, you're underwater, right? You have negative equity in your home. However, think about how deflation affects a mortgage. If you have that $1,000 a month you're paying for that mortgage payment, and inflation's going up and your real estate price is going up, it's great, right? That's still $1,000. And over time, that $1,000 will be worth less due to inflation. In deflation, it's the reverse. That $1,000 is now worth more. It's more costly to you because you have to pay that $1,000 regardless of what's going on. even though you'll have less money in wages and the whole, you know, society's costs are going down across the board, that's fixed. That's not changing. So deflation is actually one of those, I would call it a black swan that no one's talking about. And if we go into that kind of recession, that's going to cause, similar to 2008, where you have a lot of implosion in the system because people are expecting real estate to stay the same. So that's a vulnerability, right? And I'm not saying you should sell your home. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying
we shouldn't all just sell our houses and move into apartments right now.
No, I'm saying understand the risk. So that if you own a home that you're never going to sell, like a legacy home, then keep it, right? You own a vacation property, keep it. I'm not saying to sell it. I'm saying this is the paradigm shift you need to understand. So for example, like we're moving out of the city. We decided to rent instead of own. We're going to wait it out. And at some point we'll buy, but we're just not in a rush. So if you're transitioning, then rent, you know, like who cares? Mm-hmm. But this is not a Chicken Little, the sky is falling. This is how you're prepared for the next 5 to 10 years if things continue along this path. They could always change, you know, and we'll certainly let you know when that happens. But right now, the path is pretty set that this is going to be the outcome. That's something you should understand, is that leverage factor. We talked about onshoring and offshoring. People are big on tech. Everyone wants to buy FANG stocks and tech. Tech does really well in low inflation environments. So does private equity and venture capital. Everyone who uses leverage for growth, it's really great when interest rates are low. When interest rates are climbing, it's really bad for tech. It's really cheap bad money for private equity. Yeah, it's expensive money now because all the things you could do before to make money, now you can't because it's more expensive.
Well, right? A lot of tech still is tied to advertising too, right? So if the rest of the economy begins to have less cash flow, they're going to spend less money on advertising and marketing, or be at least be incredibly more selective on the return on where they're investing it.
We're already starting to see that from Facebook and Google. They're already alluding to that trend is happening. So that should continue, right? As the economy starts to adapt to this new paradigm. This is why when you see these factors, oh, the market dropped 10%, now it's more affordable, right? Now it's back to normal. Well, that's only assuming that we bounce back and go back to normal. Because if we stay in this new paradigm, then that's still expensive, which is why the markets continue to drop, is because as the earnings go down, now the market goes down, earnings drop, market drops, and it just keeps going. So this is why bear markets are hard to understand, is because people are using old numbers to adapt to what's potentially going to happen in the future. So, you know, you need to have somebody helping you navigate this because it's not easy. Let's get into some of the other areas. Rising costs. So right now, costs are going up across the board. We talked about that a little bit. Mm-hmm. In globalization, costs are lowering. I mean, it's easy to lower costs during the first 20 years. In the next few years, costs are going to rise across the board for companies, for individuals. You need to be prepared for that. Right. And you need to be more resilient and save more cash.
Well, now, Kirk, yeah, let's talk about cash for a second, because, well, with its inflation, why would I ever want to have my money in cash? Talk about why you say that.
All right. So this is a really hard topic for most people, because we've all had it beaten into our head that cash is bad. Inflation will reduce the cost of your cash. And for those people who've seen the graph from 1929 till today, the dollar is worth 97% less than it was. You know, if you had a dollar in the early 1900s, now it's worth 3 cents in comparison. So you see that graph, you're like, oh, I'd never hold cash. The problem is cash is, it's not a long-term strategy. It's a short-term strategy. So I'll give you some examples. So right now, stocks are, let's say, I'm just going to throw out some numbers, because by the time people see this, the numbers will be different. Let's say stocks are down 15%, okay? So from the beginning of the year, they're down 15%. Let's say bonds are also down 15%. Cash is equal. Cash hasn't lost any money. Commodities are up. I think they're up, I don't know, depending on the commodities, some are up 50%, but let's just say they're up 10%. You got real estate, which is probably down a little bit. Basically, if you look at all those different options, cash was your best option, even though inflation-wise, cash has lost 8% due to inflation, but you lost a lot less than you did in equities and bonds. So relative to other things, cash is great. So cash is a strategic decision as a part of a strategy. Sometimes, so take 2008. If you were all in cash, you missed all of that 50 to 60% drawdown in 2008 and 2009. Cash is a great idea. Take now, yeah, you're in cash and maybe you're losing a little money, but the equities are losing 15% plus that inflation. So whatever you're losing in cash, you're also losing in everything else. So the whole point of being in certain assets is they exceed inflation. So you break even. Let's remove inflation from the equation because that complicates it. Let's say there's no inflation. Cash right now is your best choice, right? Because you're not losing any money because everything else is going down except for commodities. So that's a great choice, right? So don't be dissuaded that cash is a bad thing due to inflation. Yes, if you were to sit on cash for 100 years, it's probably a bad thing. But if you're sitting on it for a year, 2 years, if everything else is going down, cash is your friend, you know, even though it's going to hurt.
So cash, you would say, maybe not a long-term play, but cash in itself is an asset class.
Yeah, cash is a strategic position. Most people don't like sitting on cash and they get mad. I've had calls from clients. Why are we sitting in so much cash? I'm like, well, because we're protecting your assets. Sitting on cash is not a bad thing. We're like, yeah, but we're losing out to inflation. Are you? Yeah, sure. But do you want to lose 15% in the stock market? Sure, we can put you in the stock market. You know, so I know it's hard, but let me give you another thing. If you really want to kind of rattle your brain around, here's another thing. In 2008, the stock market went down about 50%. In eight, it was 38.5%. But if you include, you know, peak to trough from the 2008 cycle, it went down like 58.5%. Okay. Let's round it to 50. So you put in $100 at the beginning of 2008, and from peak to trough, it went from $100 down to 50. So you lost 50%. What kind of returns do you need to get back to where you started?
A lot of people would say 50.
Yep. That's actually 100%. So you start with 50, you need to make another 50, get where you started. That's 100%.
You have to double it.
Right. It's really hard to make 100%, which is why for 13 years from 2000 to 2013, it took 13 years to actually break even because it's really hard making those kind of returns. Now, if you had been in cash, you didn't lose any money. Now, think of it differently. Your cash actually doubled in value because if the market went down 50%, now you can buy twice as much of it with the cash you had. So technically, your cash made you 100% return on your money if you bought at the bottom.
This is one of the reasons Buffett likes to keep cash at a lot of times when he thinks things are too expensive, because I think I heard him recently say, it gives me options tomorrow.
Yes, it's optionality is what we call it. The optionality of cash. Buffett loves it. He's had an enormous amount of cash, more than he's ever had up until recently. Now I guess he's starting to buy, or at least he said that. He loves cash because in 2008 and 2009, he went around like a kid in a candy store and was buying everything up cheap. He took advantage of everybody.
Burlington Northern.
Yeah, everyone. Yeah,
Goldman, he bought it outright.
Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, they came with their hat in their hand and said, please help us. And he's like, all right, you know, let me look through my dollar bills and you know what? Let me sharpen my pencil here and let me... I mean, he took a huge chunk out of both of those companies because he could. They needed the cash and he had it. And it's allowed him to do things that you and I can't do because we're not Warren Buffett. We don't have billions and billions of dollars in cash.
But you can learn from this.
Yes.
And you can learn from this at your own level of scale. And the other thing I think that I see with cash is ultimately, it don't matter where you have your money. When you need to go buy something, there's only one thing. I mean, things are changing. I know we've got cryptos, but there's only right now, even with crypto, most of the time you've got to convert it back to cash to buy things. And so if you want to be able to weather a lot of these challenges, it's going to be important to have liquidity, use, and control. And that's going to mean having sufficient reserves of cash to get you by when times are a little more challenging.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Cash is king, especially during these times, because no one else has it. In the Great Depression, 2008, 2009, you know, 2020, people didn't have cash because they weren't prepared for it. I mean, 2020 was great. We had a ton of cash and you go around buying stuff cheap. And there were so many opportunities at that time that lasted a week. I mean, there were things that dropped and, you know, we bought some and they doubled in a week, not because they were great investments, but because they were mispriced. If you looked at like preferred stocks at that time, a lot of them dropped in half because it wasn't because they were bad investments. It was because people needed to get out at any cost and they were willing to pay it. And if you just walked in and bought them, you could buy them at a discount. You would have made 15% yields after that. It was crazy. Same thing happened in 2008. Preferred stocks, MLPs, you could have bought them for a song and made like 20% yields on safe investments if you had the cash during that time. You could have bought tech stocks at a song. I mean, it was just, those are the times where if you have the cash, you can clean up and you can buy these world dominating companies for cheap prices that you can hold for the next 50 years if you buy them right, because they're just going to compound. This is what Buffett did, by the way. This is why Buffett's famous for his investing, because he bought things like Johnson & Johnson and Coca-Cola and all these companies that he loves. He bought them when they were dirt cheap, and he's held on to them, and he's never sold them, because every single year those dividends give him like 50% returns based on the price he paid. Why would you ever sell it? You're making 50% yields in your dividends. That's great. So that's the power of compounding. Compounding works when you buy it cheap, not when you buy it expensive.
Eighth wonder of the world. So maybe there's some other areas you think are good places to be, but I did have one question. I mean, we're hearing about inflation, we're hearing about deflation. What is this thing called stagflation?
Yeah, that's a great topic. So stagflation is what happened in the 70s. Basically, what it means is you have high inflation and your economy is stagnating. Basically, it's either not growing or it's declining. A lot of people say, oh, we're going to have stagflation, or we have stagflation. We don't have stagflation now. I would argue that we will have it probably in about a year. This is when it starts to filter through the economy, like we talked about earlier, that it takes a while. In about a year, it'll start to happen, and we will start to see this impact things significantly. But in the 70s, you had the high inflation and you didn't grow your wages. Like, your wages were stagnant or were declining, or people didn't have jobs. So that's the problem with stagflation. It is a really big problem. I think we're going to have it. The Fed will do what they can, but it gets back to the underlying theme we talked about before, is you need to be resilient. You need to prepare. Now is a good time to prepare, because you think things are bad. If things continue on this track, they're going to get worse. And I hate talking like this because I feel like, you know, Debbie Downer, but you need to understand that this is not like a walk in the park. This is tough.
And the markets may have pulled back a little bit, but if you look at where we were a year ago, they kind of just given back some of the froth. If things get worse and then we start to really see some of these things bubble up, it could be pretty damaging, not only painful looking at your statements, but if you're relying on this for your retirement and keeping up with inflation over the course of the years that you are no longer in accumulation, you know, for someone that might be going into a distribution period, this stuff we're talking about it's critical. It's life affecting if it hits.
So you just made a great point, Doug, because retirees are going to get impacted the most, because you're living off a fixed income that is not going to change, yet all your expenses are going to change. So all the people who are in tough shape because their gas, their food went up, they have the same amount of income, they're in trouble. Pensioners, retirees, they're the weakest link in the chain of the economy right now with what we're experiencing. And stagflation is an example of that. But they're going to start getting impacted now. So if you're close to retirement or in retirement, you really need to talk to somebody like Doug to talk this out, because it can be dealt with, but earlier is better. If you try to deal with this in 3 years, you're going to be in tough shape, because we're just starting to see the start of this. One other point I did want to make in the trends of before versus now, there's this whole trend of ESG. And I know someone's going to get mad at me for saying this, but the whole ESG movement on Wall
Street. Don't worry, Kirk. You say anything, somebody's going to get mad. We've learned this with Twitter. So
it's all right.
Don't worry. Just tick off the froth. And those that, you know, want to learn are going to learn something new here.
Yeah, I'm sure I've been canceled about 20 times so far. So
of course, you're not doing it right if you're not.
Yeah, right. You're not being honest. I think being honest and authentic is really important, whether you agree with it or not. I don't agree with people who are on the other side of the fence from me, but I certainly listen to them. And I think they have valid opinions, even though we disagree. But I will say that the ESG movement, Wall Street took advantage of that. And they wanted people to buy ESG because they felt good about themselves. All of that was crap, because buying into the ESG movement doesn't actually change anything. It just makes people feel good. I call it green mailing. You know, the Wall Street kind of took people to the cleaners this way. So better or worse, you know, I know people have strong opinions about this. And this is nothing to say about global warming or climate change or any of that. It's just Wall Street likes to take advantage of trends. And they did this really strongly. One thing that you need to understand is, for anybody who kind of believes that they want to save the planet and all that, in bull markets, it's easier to do that because there's a lot more wiggle room. In bear markets, you're going to lose a lot of money. Because what tends to do well in bear markets is dirty energy. Look at the stock market. If you don't believe me, look at coal companies. They've gone through the roof. Coal companies are having a field day right now. And it's funny because I forget when it was. It was like the bottom of the coal industry, like of the stock prices at the very bottom. The one ETF, I think it was KOL, the one ETF that tracked all of this closed because there wasn't enough interest. So it's always the indication of the bottom is when ETFs start closing. That's when you want to start buying. Anyway, so dirty energy is what does well. Oil.
It's efficient. It's established. It's, you can go to its, I mean, high production. I mean, I would think that ESG is a very expensive thing to invest in, which is going to be aided by cheap and easy money.
Yeah, it's not a bad ideal to have. Like, you want to make the world better. I get it. But during recessions, things that do well are sin stocks. Energy stocks, especially like cheap coal, sin stocks like smoking, tobacco, probably
a lot
pot,
of stressed out people,
alcohol, like all those companies do really well because people are still smoking. They're still drinking. You know, they still have to drive their car. All those things hold up. And if you want, if you don't believe me, look at some of those stocks. You'll see they've done really well. Some of them are positive this year, even though the market's down a lot. So just understand that like the trends are changing across the board and you need to check all of your assumptions, not just, you know, one or two. You need to check them all. There's two things I want to tell you that, you should be looking at to protect yourself.
Okay.
For business owners, like I said earlier, you want to look at all your vulnerabilities, reduce as many as possible, reduce your risks, right? Across the board. You need to start thinking short-term instead of long-term. Your long-term planning, you throw it out the window. Because things are going to change a lot in unexpected ways, things that nobody can predict, right? Nobody could predict COVID. You know, the government's going to take action at some point. You can't predict what the government's going to do. So you just have to assume that things are going to happen and change your strategy.
So prepare for the challenges to come, reduce the froth, and make sure that you've got a business that's still running effective, but is also being as efficient as it possibly can right now.
Correct. Areas or asset classes you should consider: cash, commodities. We talked about apartment rentals, industrial, manufacturing, precious metals, and mining stocks should do well. Mm-hmm. Producers like farmland, right? Things, because the commodity prices are going up, but the costs are somewhat. But some of these producers are going to make more money. So I love farmland. Farmland has been in the doldrums for a long time, and that's starting to do really well. Ukraine has kind of put a finer
point
on that.
Bill Gates will be happy about that.
Yes,
he'll
be very
happy for that for a while.
Yes. So those are really some of the better areas that you can look at. There's a lot of other things that will probably be tough, but I would say those are the areas. I mean, a lot of people want to short the market. It goes down. I think that's kind of a fool's errand, shorting the market. If you're good at it, great. But there's so very few people that are good at it. So it's almost not even worth pursuing.
If you're wrong, the risk is unlimited. And one thing I want to add on the cash, and you mentioned earlier with we might end up in a period where there's a lot of volatility, where active trading could come back into play. It seems like as part of this equation too, things that might be, you know, maybe some more alternatives that can go up but can't go down, especially with your cash, if you're parking it, things that might index with performance but not lose money. Again, diversification of, you know, things that are different than maybe people have been playing in the last 10 to 15 years as the market has just gone on one big rocket, you know, shot to the moon, as they call it. These times are changing.
There aren't a lot of assets, I'll tell you. I mean, those are the big ones that I like. I love farmland. I think that's a great asset. It's hard to invest in, but there's some ways you can do it. But risk management's really important. I mean, this is why, you know, you and I work together, Doug, is because we focus on risk management. We specialize in risk management, whether it's traditional or alternative assets. We're really good with alternative assets, but we're unbiased. I don't really care about the asset. I care, is this a good investment? Does this make sense? So our strategy changes according to the markets because we have to adapt. And one of the things that we do is most people, like I said, are buy and hold. We're focused on risk management. And I'll tell you why, because most people are outcome-based thinking. As human beings, we all focus on outcome-based thinking, right? Who's going to get elected in the next election? What's the weather going to do tomorrow? What's the stock market going to do? We're all thinking about this outcome-based thinking. Yet the more rational way to go is what we call scenario-based thinking. So like an election, like take the last election. What are we going to do if Trump wins? What are we going to do if Biden wins? Or the third option was, what if it's unclear, which is a very probabilistic scenario at the time. I'm not going to predict which is going to win because I don't know. But I know that no matter what the outcome is, we're prepared for it. So COVID, good example. When COVID hit, no one knew that was going to happen. And nobody knew it was going to crash the markets 30 some odd percent. And no one knew it was go back and exceed that before the end of the year. It was crazy. It's just unimaginable. We didn't know that, but we were prepared for it. So even though the market went down a lot, we didn't, because we were prepared for it. We were prepared for the unknown. And I think that's really the focus you need to have, is that kind of scenario-based thinking, because as things get more complex and more confusing, you're not going to know the outcome, but you can prepare for it. And that's what's really important to Doug and myself, is that you're prepared for this paradigm shift so that when it comes, you can shrug it off. It's not going to be easy, and it's probably still going to be painful, but it's going to be a lot easier than the people who are not prepared. You know, look at COVID, when people were stocking up on toilet paper and wet wipes because they didn't have any, and they would go to the store twice a week to go buy them. That's going to really cause a problem.
And they got into it late, and so now they still have stockpiles of toilet paper and wet wipes because they reacted. And I think that makes a great point, the preparedness, right? Sometimes it means making those moves and shifts when it doesn't seem like those moves and shifts are, you know, make sense, because something might be doing well. I mean, you know, again, Warren Buffett sitting on lots of cash when the markets were rocking and rolling, he got a lot of questions about why he's sitting on cash. That money should be invested. He was preparing. And, you know, his rule number one, don't lose money. Rule number two, refer to rule number one. In order to do that, you have to be able to look at what's going on and prepare ahead of time for the things that might be coming.
Right. And if you think about the concept of resilience, you know, there's this fragility, resilience, and then there's anti-fragile, if you read Taleb's book. You know, the way I think about it is there's fragility, which is the stock market, right? The real estate bubble was fragility. The whole system assumed that real estate prices would go up. And when it didn't, everything broke apart. Now you think about things like resilience. Resilience is being tougher, being able to take the fact that, yeah, real estate's going down, but I didn't overleverage myself, so I'm okay. You take anti-fragile, which is, it's kind of like hormesis for those of you who are doctors. You know, it's like you give yourself a little harm, it creates this this effect in your body. It's like a vaccine. I don't want to go down the rabbit hole, but the point of a vaccine
now is you're going to really get people upset.
I know. But forget COVID, but just a vaccine in general, because everyone's had some sort of a vaccine, whether it's the flu or chickenpox, whatever. So the point of a vaccine is you give yourself a little harm, it allows your body to adapt to it, and then it causes a protection against that next time you see it. Smallpox vaccine, right? So it's this hormesis. It's this effect that a little harm causes great benefit, this anti-fragility. So when you're thinking about your life, when you're thinking about the markets, think about these concepts of how you can be more resilient. Because if you're fragile, you're going to really get harmed. But being anti-fragile it's okay, but you have to balance that out. Because if you're on one side of the spectrum, it's just as bad as being on the other. But being resilient is really being able to withstand tough times so that no matter what happens, you're prepared, so that on the other side of it, you can take advantage of opportunities when they arise.
Well, so a couple of things that I'm definitely hearing is prepare for change, that we are going through something, we may be going through something that almost nobody alive has really truly experienced in their lifetime. We've got a paradigm shift that is coming that ultimately is going to mean that some of the things that you thought were true could turn out to be untrue. And I think that's an important question is, if the things that you think are true about passive investing, stock markets, your money, the economy turn out to be untrue, when would you want to know? And if that means right now, then you need to begin to maybe ask the questions and get the information and help, whether it's from someone like myself or Kirk, who really are looking at these things in a preparedness sort of light, because a lot of people out there are just going to keep doing the same thing, turning the same wheel over and over. And unfortunately, if this paradigm does shift, they could bring you down with it. We may not see the same things in the next 5 to 10 years that you have ever seen or known how to weather before. And again, we don't believe that you should ever lose a dollar you didn't have to. And in order to prevent that, just like Warren Buffett says, to not lose money, you need to be able to prepare today. Do the right things, be where you need to go, be fluid, be able to shift with what we're seeing that could be coming in the economy so that you can keep your hard-earned dollars working for you, because it's all you're ever going to have, right? The dollars that you make, it's finite. So losing it can have a tremendous impact. And therefore, that's why we believe that not losing money is rule number one as well. So anything else you wanted to add today? This has been incredibly informative. I think, you know, those that have listened to this are going to feel that this was incredibly helpful, because I know those questions are out there, whether people are asking it or not.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk, Doug, with your listeners. And I think the one thing to ask each one should ask yourselves is, where am I wrong? And how do I know when I'm wrong? And I ask myself this question all the time, especially when it comes to investing. So I do want to thank everyone for this. Has been a long episode. And I think we're going to have some more because we've had a lot of questions and we're going to have these continually. So please send your questions to Doug or myself, and we'll have additional videos to talk through these. It's really important. You know, we care about each one of you, and we want to make sure you're prepared for this. You know, don't look at this as an opportunity. Look at this as a way to protect yourself and your family. So thanks again for having me, Doug.
This is a lot of fun, Kirk. I look forward to our next one and doing this again.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.